Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Monday, November the 16th. A very good morning and welcome to Africa Link. I am Abubakar Jallo in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, the government of Burundi welcomes a UN resolution to prevent the violence in the country from turning into a civil war.
The Burundian government commends the very wise content of the resolution, which is in line with the government's will to solve the crisis currently prevailing in the country.
And in Angola, 17 activists will appear in court today, accused of attempting to overthrow President José Eduardo dos Santos.
They were mobilizing people and teaching them how to topple a government based on Sharpsburg.
These stories plus a new episode of Learning by Ear's Crime Fighters. Stay tuned.
Top story.
The government of Burundi has welcomed a United Nations resolution to prevent the violence in the country from turning into a civil war. The resolution calls for urgent talks between the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza and opposition groups that reject the president's third term in power. The violence which broke out in April has killed at least 240 people. From Bujumbura, Apollinaire Nyirora sent this report.
Following the UN Security Council resolution that called for inclusive dialogue to end the political crisis in Burundi, both government and the opposition are now optimistic that through dialogue they will be able to work together and bring an end to the violence that has left scores dead and forced at least 200,000 to seek refuge in neighboring countries. Government spokesman Philippe Nzobonariba called it a very wise move and said his government would expeditiously work to implement it.
The Burundian government commends the very wise content of the resolution, which is in line with the government's will to solve the crisis currently prevailing in the country, notably through dialogue promotion that has always been its priority. The government urges its partners that still hesitate to relaunch cooperation to do it without delay, because it's the only solution that will bring a sustainable response to real problems Burundians are facing, namely poverty.
The ruling party, the CNDD-FDD, also held the resolution, but its spokesman criticized some diplomats accredited to Burundi for their indirect role in what is happening in the country. Daniel Gerard Ndabirabe is the ruling party spokesman.
The security and political situation in Burundi have been poorly understood by some countries due to some diplomats in Bujumbura giving false information to their respective countries.
On its part, the opposition also expressed its satisfaction because the resolution provides strict respect of the Arusha Agreement. Charles Nditije, the leader of the UPRONA party that fought for Burundi's independence, called on the international community to put UN peacekeepers on standby in order to prevent large-scale violence.
We're glad that the resolution urged strict respect of the spirit and letter of the Arusha Agreement. They also recommended that UN peacekeepers be ready to intervene in case of massive violence, which looks imminent. We invite the international community, the AU and the EAC, to force Nkurunziza to negotiate without conditions and quickly, and if need be, to have them ready in order to come and impose peace in Burundi.
The Council appointed a special advisor for the prevention of conflicts and urged the UN Secretary General to give, within 15 days, options for a future presence of UN peacekeepers in Burundi.
Apollinaire Nyirora in Bujumbura. Now, in a video message on Saturday, US President Barack Obama urged leaders in Burundi to put aside what he described as the language of hate and division. My colleague Isaac Mugabe has been speaking to Phil Clark from SOAS, the University of London, about the timing of an international intervention.
I think the resolution of the UN Security Council shows just how confused and unsure the UN is about what to do during a very volatile time in Burundi. I think the UN is holding out hope that the mediation efforts by the African Union and the East African community can bring about some sort of resolution to the situation in Burundi. But the reality on the ground seems to be that mediation is not having much of an effect. And so the UN is very reluctant to go down the line of some sort of peacekeeping intervention. But I think the UN might find in the next week or two that it has no choice and it's going to have to send peacekeepers in.
Well, both the government and the opposition have hailed the resolution. Do you see them sitting together to restore peace and security in their country, given the fact that it's not the first time that Burundi's politicians are urged to iron out their differences amicably?
It does seem that the dialogue between the government and the opposition has broken down once again. And I think it's clear that the East African community's mediation in the talks, particularly with the Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, has failed so far. Dialogue simply doesn't seem to be working. The US, I see, is trying to draw South Africa much more into the mediation process. President Obama was on the phone to President Zuma on Thursday, trying to get South Africa to play a much more proactive role in the mediation. But the actions of the government over the last 3 or 4 months suggest that they may be talking to the opposition, but at the same time, they're continuing to kill human rights activists, they're continuing to kill opposition leaders and suspected opponents of the government in neighborhoods in Bujumbura.
You've done extensive research on both Burundi and Rwanda. Don't you think that what is happening right now in Burundi could turn out to be another catastrophe, like was the case in Rwanda in 1994?
I obviously hope that Burundi doesn't go down the pathway of Rwanda, but I do think that many similar ingredients to what we saw during the Rwandan genocide are relevant in Burundi today. We're seeing the involvement of militia groups carrying out systematic violence against innocent civilians. We're seeing government ministers use very inflammatory language, increasingly ethnically based inflammatory language. We're seeing a very large refugee flow, which is making the region around extremely volatile. And we can see the fear and the paranoia of everyday Burundians about what might happen in the weeks to come. Now, many commentators have said that the Burundian conflict, thankfully, in recent years has been political rather than ethnic. And the suggestion has been that we should take some sort of comfort in this. But I think that that's very naive thinking. I think that even politically motivated rather than ethnically motivated violence can wreak enormous havoc in the population. And we should be just as worried about politically based violence as we should be about ethnically based violence.
Phil Clark from SOAS, the University of London.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
To Angola now, where 17 rights activists will appear in court today, accused of attempting to overthrow President José Eduardo dos Santos. A top government official says the activists plan to use women and children in a campaign against the president, who has been in power for almost 36 years. Guilherme da Silva has more.
Laurinda Gouveia and a group of friends used to meet every Saturday at a bookstore in the heart of the Angolan capital, Luanda. There, they like to discuss one particular book, Gene Sharp's From Dictatorship to Democracy, a tutorial written in 1993 that lists 198 methods of nonviolent resistance.
We talked about the peaceful struggle Gene Sharp describes in his book. The reason we chose to study Sharp was that, while we had organized anti-establishment activities before, we felt we needed to learn from other people's experience.
One Saturday last June, police officers went to the bookstore. Laurinda wasn't there, but 13 of her friends were. They were arrested on the spot. According to Duchentus' special envoy for political issues, Ambassador Antonio Luvualo de Carvalho, the activists were up to much more than just reading a subversive book.
They were mobilizing people and teaching them how to topple a government based on Sharp's book. They planned to use children, women, and the elderly. They wanted them to crash with security forces so that security forces would kill them. They estimated that between 20 and 25 people would die. The purpose was to generate worldwide uproar and encourage Western countries, especially NATO members, to bomb Angola.
Laurindo Gouveia says that it is inconceivable that a group of 17 young activists with no weapons should plan something like that.
We didn't talk about using children or women or elderly people. We never prepared anything.
Since the arrests at the bookstore, hundreds of people have protested for more freedom of expression in Angola, inside the country and abroad. Angolan security forces dispersed several protests in support of the activists, saying they were illegal. By the end of October, human rights group Amnesty International had collected more than 38,000 signatures for a petition calling for the immediate release of the activists. Teresa Pina is the head of Amnesty International in Portugal.
This is just another case in a long history of punishing dissent in Angola, and it has worsened in recent months. A state which lets its citizens endanger their own lives is a state willing to do anything.
That report was compiled by Guilherme da Silva. Now to Nigeria, where the mobile phone giant MTN has been in talks with the country's Communications Commission, the NCC, over a $5.2 billion fine. The fine, which is due to be paid today, Monday, was slammed on MTN for its failure to cut off unregistered SIM cards. Nigeria has been pushing for phone operators to verify the identities of subscribers in an effort to combat cybercrime and terrorism. Isaac Mugabe asked our correspondent in Lagos, Sam Olukoya, if anything had transpired from the meetings.
Well, so far there has been no indication either from the Nigerian Communications Commission, which imposed the fine, or from MTN, which is supposed to pay the fine. And there's nothing so far to show for it. Though what we are hearing is that both sides are negotiating. And of course, as you may know, the chief executive of MTN had been in Nigeria, and his mission in Nigeria is to negotiate a downward review of the amount. We hear MTN is proposing as much as 80% reduction.
Now, in case MTN fails to meet the deadline, what are the likely sanctions that the NCC is bound to take?
The NCC will have a handful of options. Worst case scenario will be a revocation of MTN's license to operate in Nigeria. Another option might be to impose another fine for their lateness in paying the fine. And then the third option might be an extension that, in view of the fact that the money is huge, they are giving MTN some more time to pay up.
How concerned are MTN subscribers in case the two parties, that is MTN and the NCC, fail to resolve this issue?
As you know, MTN is the largest operator in Nigeria. The last statistics shows that they have as many as 61.1 million subscribers. So it's a big issue in Nigeria. I mean, people are not very sure what will happen. But so far, one assumption is that MTN's service might deteriorate. If so much money is taken from them, then they might not have enough money to have to run efficiently, and then the service might go down. And in fact, in the last days, when I make calls and then it's not very clear. People say, well, maybe this issue has started taking a hold on MTN. That's why the service is not very clear. Some say possibly the tariff might go up in order to pass part of the burden to the subscribers. And then there's also the rumor that they might have to reduce their workforce in order to make up for this huge sum of money they are being asked to pay.
Sam Olukoya in Lagos. It's time now to sit back and enjoy another segment of Learning by Ears Crime Fighters.
Deutsche Welle, Learning by Ear,
Listen up. Shape your future.
Welcome to the third episode of Crime Fighters, The Radical Journey. Our story takes place in Kululaland. Brenda and Jude, two young police officers, are trying to unravel the mystery behind the death of Zora Kasim, a young woman who died carrying out a suicide bomb attack. How did an excellent student from a good family end up becoming a terrorist? The search is still on to find out who masterminded the attack. Jude has decided to go to some popular youth hangouts. He wants to talk to those most likely to be approached by terrorist groups, the young and unemployed. Will he find more clues to help piece the mystery together? Listen to this new episode called Nobody's Perfect.
Oh, hi, Brenda.
Hi, Jude.
Zora's friend Patricia came in yesterday while you were out. She didn't really have any new information, though. I'm going to go to a place called Ziggy's later today. It's one of the youth hangouts I was talking about.
Oh, good.
How about you? How was your visit to the prison? Any leads?
I interviewed two women. One was Zora's age. She has two kids. She was very sad and angry after her husband was killed. So when Scambo and his terror group offered to help her, she was very grateful to them. The second girl was younger, only about 15.
15? Unbelievable.
The horror she's seen.
How did she end up in this situation?
She told me some masked men came to their house one night. The family was just about to go to sleep. They were completely taken by surprise when these brutal men burst in on them.
Who is it? Out of the way, you old fool. Check the house. Bring everybody you find in here to the sitting room.
I'll do that.
What do you want? Please, I beg you, take anything you want, but leave me and my family alone.
What do you think you can give me?
Please, please.
You too. Come with me.
Please. What have we done to you?
Shut up. They're all here.
So, this is your wife?
Yes.
Anna, is this your only daughter?
Yes, sir. Please, I beg you, leave them out of this.
Take the girl to the car. We are leaving.
No. Come on.
Get off me. No.
No. No, please, I beg you.
They killed her father in cold blood. She says she can still hear her mother's screams.
Did she say who her kidnappers were?
All she remembers is being kidnapped and taken away by terrorists. Everything after that is a blank. She was found by some students near the university, lying on the ground, delirious, wearing a bomb belt.
What a terrible story.
Good afternoon. What can I get you to drink?
I'd like a lemonade, please.
Hey, Jude! Hey, I thought it was you.
Bobo, how are you? I haven't seen you since high school. I never thought I'd say it, but I kind of miss school.
Those were the days. A lot has happened since then, though. You've been to university and everything. Please, take a seat. I'll join you. Bartender, I'll have what he's having.
Okay, so that's two glasses of lemonade.
Lemonade? Jude, too much sugar isn't good for us. So, what brings you here? I've never seen you in this place before.
Are you a regular here?
24/7. You'll always find me at Ziggy's.
There you go.
Thanks. Thank you.
Enjoy.
Tell me, I heard you were shortlisted for the police force interview. Did you get in?
Nah, I didn't. How about you, Bobo? What are you doing now?
I've been searching for a job, but no luck. The thing is, I am in serious need of cash. I have a big debt I need to pay off.
Things are really difficult these days.
I blame the government and those greedy politicians for everything. Kululaland has a long coastline and so many resources. This country is a natural economic hub. Why is this government incapable of providing job opportunities for young people? Huh?
You know, I think every government is somehow a reflection of the people. So if you have a government that's basically a privileged few ripping everyone off, what does that say about the voters?
Oh, come on, my friend. The people know what they are doing, and they are ready to take to the streets if they don't like the way they are being treated. Young people are starting to take matters into their own hands, and their actions are going to shock this government.
What do you mean?
Dude, you have no idea what's really going on in this country, do you? I see you've got a lot of catching up to do. Young people are tired and angry. And now we are doing something about it. Why don't you come over and join us tomorrow evening? Most of the group will be there, and you and I will be able to talk properly.
Tomorrow evening... Yeah, okay, I'll be there.
Inspector Brenda, what happened? I just saw your message.
Commissioner, sir, good afternoon. The anti-terror squad working on the bomb blast here at police headquarters arrested some suspected terrorists last night.
I hope you didn't call me here to tell me something I already know.
No, sir. There's more. The team invited me to listen in on the interrogation we started this morning. One of the suspects said some things you might want to hear for yourself. He's still in the interrogation room. If you'd like to follow me.
But of course, let's go. Let's go.
He only agreed to talk after striking a deal with the anti-terror squad to get a smaller penalty. But he's being very cooperative now. So, Mr. Eric Mudu, this is Police Commissioner Cletus.
Hello?
You were telling me about the man who recruited you?
Yes, Inspector. He's a banker working with the Drofox Financial Company.
This banker, what's his name?
His name is Maga. At least that's what everybody calls him.
What kind of work do you do for him?
We carry out attacks on police stations and government property.
What kind of weapons do you use? And how do you get them?
It depends. Some of us use guns. Some have worn bomb belts and carried out suicide attacks. But he only gives us the guns just before each attack.
What do you mean it depends? Depends on what? And what do you mean by some of us?
There are different groups. Some of us live in the community and nobody suspects us, so we carry out the silent attacks. It's mostly the others, the ones who live in the training camps, who do the suicide bombings.
How much does this MAGA guy pay you?
He gave me 800,000 the last time.
Where does he get that kind of money and the weapons?
He gets help from his friends. They're very well connected.
Does he also work with Scambo, the warlord?
Yes.
Tell the commissioner who these well-connected friends are, Mr. Mudu.
I know of two members of the regional assembly. I don't know their names. We call them house members. Then there's a commissioner, the commissioner of finance, Honorable Kasim, and some other politicians.
Honorable Kasim?
Yes, sir.
And that's the end of today's episode. Jude suspects that his old classmate Bobo has fallen in with bad company, and he intends to find out more. New evidence also appears to link Zora's father, Honorable Kasim, with a terrorist group, the same group the police suspect was behind Zora's attack. But the big question is, even if Honorable Kasim really is linked to the Sword Sages, how did Zora come into the picture? Join us next time so we can try and piece together what's going on. In the meantime, you can visit our website, dw.com/crimefighters, or join us for a discussion on Facebook. Take care and goodbye.
And before we leave you, a reminder of the main stories. The government of Burundi has welcomed a United Nations resolution to prevent the violence in the country from turning into a civil war. In Angola, 17 activists will appear in court today, accused of attempting to overthrow President José Eduardo dos Santos. For more news, please visit our website tw.com/Africa. And until tomorrow, my name is Abubakar Jallo in Bonn, Germany. Bye for now.